Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. When Marx began the Communist Manifesto with the line, "A specter is haunting Europe," the dense intertextual weaving of horror fiction and political anxiety had already begun. Mary Shelley's father, the anarchist William Godwin, had written a political horror novel titled Things as They Are. Bram Stoker was inspired by his tyrannical boss to write Dracula as a form of sublimated workers' action, and later the Dracula film in 1931 would serve to reinforce anxieties about devious Central Europeans with accents coming to the West with their dangerous anti-religious ideas. The post-war horror film saw nuclear anxiety and red scares writ large in giant insects and alien body snatchers. One of the most enduring and influential horror writers, however, has been H.P. Lovecraft, and his political anxieties were many. As Lovecraft penned the dozens of stories and books that sketched out his Cthulhu mythos, his politics morphed from aristocratic monarchism to New Deal socialism, with a strong dash of racialism and elitism thrown in. To explain who Lovecraft was and how his politics influences his work, or vice versa, I'm speaking today with the leading editor of Lovecraft's work and author of his most authoritative biographies, S.T. Joshi. Mr. Joshi has also written extensively on weird fiction, editing weird fiction journals, and is the author most recently of The Modern Weird Tale, a study of weird fiction since World War II. So tell us a little bit about Lovecraft. He was a native of Providence.
He lived almost his whole life in Providence, Rhode Island, with the exception of 2 years in New York when he was briefly and unhappily married. He identified greatly with Providence and considered himself a New England gentleman of the old school. But he grew up at a time in the 1890s when these notions of social aristocracy were still very strong, and so he developed those ideas. And yet he also developed very early on the idea that the real aristocracy is the aristocracy of intellect, and so he began studies of various kinds quite early. He claimed to have suffered a nervous breakdown really after only 3 years of high school, and for the next 5 years he became a kind of a hermit, a recluse, and that's where he picked up a great deal of his knowledge that would serve him later on. His very, very early juvenilia, when he started writing at the age of 6 or 7, was poetry of a classical sort. For example, he produced a sort of abridgment of the Odyssey in about 88 lines. It's really a remarkable piece of compression.
As a child.
As a child. So he learned the Greco-Roman classics at a very early age. He learned Latin as early as the age of 8 or 9. He had a smattering of Greek, but he developed a great fascination for the 18th century, particularly such poets as Alexander Pope, Samuel Johnson, and of course the prose writers of that period. So his writing, both prose and poetry, always had a sort of archaic cast to them, and really it remained right to the end.
You'd have thought that after John Stuart Mill's nervous breakdown that parents of an aristocratic education bent would have learned not to teach their kids Latin and Greek.
You'd think so, but it would seem he learned it largely by himself. In fact, he produced a little translation of a bit of Ovid as early as the age of 10 or so. A remarkable youth. But there's another side to Lovecraft in that he was on one side devoted to belles lettres, but on another side devoted to science. He learned chemistry and astronomy at a very early age and became fascinated with astronomy, particularly from about the age of 12 or 13 onward. And in fact, that he claimed later that developed what he called his cosmic attitude, his notion that the Earth and everything on it was a very transient and insignificant element in the vast cosmos at large.
And alien life formed a great part of his later fiction.
Yes, although in my understanding. I believe those the various extraterrestrial entities that he puts on stage are really symbols. I mean, he obviously didn't believe literally in the existence of such extraterrestrials. They served as symbols for the vast unknown universe of which we can only grasp a very tiny fraction.
Mm-hmm. So he saw himself principally as a poet at first. When did he begin to become a fiction writer?
He really didn't write much fiction until about 1917, when he was in his later 20s. At that time, he'd received some encouragement from colleagues to write fiction, and it still didn't really take to it until the 1920s. Indeed, the foundation of the pulp magazine Weird Tales in 1923 did provide an impetus of a sort, although Lovecraft always felt somewhat embarrassed being published in Weird Tales or in these other pulp magazines, because he realized, frankly, that their readership was of a somewhat low level. He would have liked to have seen the emergence of a high-grade magazine devoted to weird fiction, but the market simply couldn't bear that kind of a magazine, and still can't, for that matter.
Well, what distinguished Weird Tales from the early science fiction that was being written at the time?
Well, Weird Tales really was the only magazine at the time devoted to pure horror and the supernatural. Lovecraft later appeared in some of the science fiction magazines when his work took a more scientific cast, but his early work was quite supernatural, very derivative of Poe in many regards. He regarded Poe as his god of fiction, as he called him once. And again, that early work looks backward rather than forward. It looks back to the 19th century and his influences, Poe, Ambrose Bierce, Arthur Machen, and some of these other writers. So Weird Tales really was, by necessity, his only viable professional market for this early work.
Now, he was not very popular during the course of his writing career. When did his popularity begin to grow?
Well, it's funny. In 1937, when he died, Lovecraft really had only one book of his stories ever published, and that had appeared the year before, a really wretched small press publication of The Shadow Over Innsmouth. So I'm sure that when he died, he was convinced that his work would simply lapse into oblivion, lost in the pages of these crumbling pulp magazines. But he had developed such strong ties with friends and colleagues that two writers named August Derleth and Donald Wandry took the effort to resurrect Lovecraft's work, save it from these pulp magazines, and publish it in book form by forming the publishing company Arkham House. And since 1939, Arkham House has been perhaps the leading publisher of Lovecraft's work. It's an amazing story how this little-known writer has now become a sort of a popular culture icon, if you want to call it that. I think Lovecraft really took off when paperback editions began to appear, really in the 1970s with Ballantine Books. That really ensured his popularity, because they received tremendously wide distribution, sold in the millions of copies. And now Lovecraft is disseminated around the world in translation and other editions.
I'm speaking today with S.T. Joshi. He's the principal biographer and editor of Lovecraft, H.P. Lovecraft. Now, what were the principal themes of his fiction? And was the Cthulhu mythos throughout his fiction, or was this just a minor part of his fiction?
The Cthulhu mythos is very difficult to specify, and I am one of the scholars who maintain that it is not as important to Lovecraft's work as many others believe. In fact, it should be noted that Lovecraft himself never came up with the term Cthulhu mythos. That was coined by August Derleth only after Lovecraft's death. He had some idea, of course, that he was evolving a sort of what he called a pseudo-mythology in some of his work, not all, but in some of his major tales. He sometimes referred to it whimsically as Cthulhuism or Yog-Sothothery, which suggests that he didn't take it as seriously as many have later. My belief is that what Lovecraft was doing here was creating what one scholar, David E. Schultz, has called an anti-mythology. By that, I mean this. The purpose of most mythologies and religions is, as it were, to reconcile humanity with the universe. That is to say, to explain the the place of humanity within the confines of space and time. Lovecraft reverses that by saying, rather, whereas religion says, yes, human beings are at the center of the universe, both and are the special product of the benevolence of an all-powerful God, Lovecraft says, no, human beings are completely insignificant. They are at the mercy of these titanic forces that really care nothing about them and that can brush them aside and destroy them without even a moment's thought. Lovecraft himself was indeed an atheist. He claimed to become an atheist as early as the age of 5. One doesn't know if that's really the case or not, but certainly by his teenage years, and under the influence of astronomy and some of the philosophers he was reading, like Nietzsche and Bertrand Russell, he evolved a very strong atheist tendency. Now, in fact, it might seem a paradox that Lovecraft created all these gods and monsters in his stories, and yet was an atheist. But as I say, these gods really are symbols for all the mystery of the universe, and they are not to be taken literally. So in many ways, his fiction does embody an atheist outlook.
Although there may be some supernatural aspects, it's really a fundamentally a materialist set of stories in the sense that they're not ghosts. They're usually monsters of some kind that have some kind of psychic power over mankind.
Absolutely. Lovecraft very early realized that many of the standard conceptions in horror fiction, like the ghost, the haunted house, werewolves, vampires, had become completely stale and lacking in any sort of symbolic value. He realized that he had to create completely new entities in order to get the points across that he wished to get across. Therefore, yes, many of his monsters are simply extraterrestrials that obey laws of entity that we are simply unfamiliar with. I think his greatest achievement in this regard was in The Color Out of Space, where we have very little idea of what the entity or entities in that story really are, but they have a profound influence upon humanity as they come into contact with human beings.
I suppose the great exception to what we're saying is the Necronomicon, which has assumed a bizarre cultic status among occultists who believe that it actually exists. What was the Necronomicon?
One cannot. I mean, Lovecraft is not responsible for what has been done in his name. But even the concept of the Necronomicon has undergone significant revisions throughout the course of Lovecraft's own literary career. I think initially he created it around 1921, 22 as a sort of repository of occult knowledge, occult in the most literal sense of the term, of knowledge that is hidden from the mass of humanity. But later on, you can see that Lovecraft himself suggests that the author of the Necronomicon, Abdul al-Hazred, is himself mistaken in what he conceives to be the various gods that he writes about in that book. At the Mountains of Madness, Lovecraft says, oh, yes, these extraterrestrials that settled in Antarctica are the true originals of the gods that al-Hazred wrote about. So al-Hazred himself has written a sort of erroneous scripture in which he himself does not understand the true nature of the entities he's discussing.
Mm. So who were some of the principal features, characters that inhabit his works? Is there a particular nemesis or particular evil entity that goes throughout?
I don't think one can say that, because Lovecraft very early on realized that the notions of good and evil are purely human constructs. In fact, one of his greatest utterances came in 1926 when he wrote The Call of Cthulhu. That was perhaps the first story in which he utilized this.
And what does it mean? What does Cthulhu mean?
One doesn't know. the name Cthulhu was devised by Lovecraft as a purely non-human term. I mean, if an extraterrestrial is to have come from the depths of space, then his name must also be completely alien to human vocal organs. And so that's why there's so much debate as to how one even pronounces the name. But Cthulhu is simply an entity that came from space and by a series of accidents became lodged underwater in his stone city of Rilje. And in the story, The Call of Cthulhu, he emerges for a moment, but then, by a series of accidents, falls back down. So I think in that story, Lovecraft is suggesting the very dubious hold that human beings have upon the earth, that they are themselves not the rulers of the earth, that in fact there are secret forces all around them that could wipe them out if they took the trouble to do so. That's right.
Now, you've compiled a lot of his work together. Do you see a trajectory in his stories? Did he become darker over the course of his writing career?
Well, I think that what gradually evolved is an increasing sense of scientific verisimilitude. Early on in his work, he devoted himself to writing, as I say, in the manner of Poe or Bierce. Lord Dunsany, the Irish fantasist, was a strong influence. A lot of these stories, one doesn't really know what the entity in question is. Sometimes it's ill-defined, the phenomena are not well-defined. But with The Call of Cthulhu in 1926, Lovecraft realized that one had to present a kind of scientific justification for the supernatural events. And that's why some of his later work did indeed find its way into the science fiction pulp magazines, things like The Color Out of Space, The Shadow Out of Time, At the Mountains of Madness. And these become virtually tales of science fiction, except that the horror element is still paramount.
I'm speaking with S.T. Joshi. He's the principal editor of H.P. Lovecraft's work and the principal biographer of H.P. Lovecraft. And H.P. Lovecraft was a horror writer at the early part of this century. Now, Lovecraft started as a monarchist and evolved to a New Deal socialist. How did all that come about?
I think the evolution of Lovecraft's political philosophy has been one of the most fascinating changes in his whole philosophical thought, and I think it argues for a really wide-scale freedom of thought in Lovecraft. Lovecraft very rarely felt bound to adhere to his original conceptions. Once new evidence came to light, he felt the need to revise his views in light of this new evidence. As I say, he began as a monarchist. I think more out of sort of nostalgia. He remembered what it was like to live in a stable age. In the later 19th century, his Anglophilia led him to believe that the American Revolution was a mistake, that America should have remained tied to England. Even as late as the early 1920s, we see him supporting the rise of Mussolini and fascism. But with the onset of the Great Depression, I think Lovecraft began coming to serious terms with fundamental problems of politics and society. And he realized that laissez-faire capitalism simply produced tragedy in its exploitation of the masses by powerful capitalist forces. And so he supported FDR and the New Deal, but didn't think they were going far enough. He wanted even more radical change, although I think he knew that politically at that time it was not going to happen. And at the same time, however, while advocating economic relief to the many, he did maintain a belief that political power should be restricted to the few. He maintained that the political suffrage was something that one has to earn rather than one than something that is merely granted by mere virtue of being a citizen. He wished the institution of some kind of intellectual or political test to allow for suffrage, so that while economic wealth should be spread to the many, political power should be restricted to the few. This is what he evolved as the notion of fascistic socialism, which sounds like a paradox, but really isn't, because Lovecraft felt that in many ways the spheres of politics and economics were separate and could be dealt with separately.
So by the fascism, he meant a certain elitism of political power.
That's right, because he was convinced that the average citizen was, aside from being not very intelligent to begin with, was simply unaware of the complexities of the political situation as the technological age was advancing. Lovecraft was influenced by a lot of political thought that was going on at the time. In particular, there was something called the Technocracy Survey in the early 1930s, which showed that technological evolution had made political dealings extremely complicated and beyond the understanding of the average person. And so Lovecraft felt that a restriction of the vote would be the only way to ensure that competence in political action could be achieved.
Yet, in one of your writings about Lovecraft's political ideas, you point to something that he wrote about how his aristocracy, his belief in aristocracy led to his socialism, in the sense that he believed that human beings should have a certain high moral character and a certain disinterestedness about life and a set of other attributes that he attributed to aristocracy. And he writes that all of these things could be achieved under socialism. So he believed, like Bertrand Russell and others, that socialism could reshape the character of human beings.
He did indeed. I think what Lovecraft really objected to about capitalism in particular was its vaunting of money as the prime criterion of all value. Lovecraft himself disdained money and disdained the need to scrounge around for money just to continue living. He felt that there was enough money in the world that people shouldn't have to do that. And he felt that with a more rational distribution of resources, people could devote themselves more extensively to aesthetic appreciation. They could read more books. They could listen to more music. They could appreciate more art. Lovecraft objected to the idea that that human beings should define themselves merely by their occupation, merely by their remunerative function in society. He frequently said, "Why do we call? Why do we refer to John Smith as a plumber instead of John Smith as appreciator of Beethoven or something like that?" He felt that the money motive was a very corrupting influence in society, and he wished somehow to put that aside.
Would he have considered it an irony that his principal biographer these days is an Indian American, or would he have considered you an honorary member of the Aryan race?
Yes, I wondered what Lovecraft would have thought of me. This gets into the whole idea of Lovecraft's racism or racialism or whatever you wish to term it. I regret to say that this is indeed one of the black marks in Lovecraft's character, and it cannot be explained away. Lovecraft developed these racialist attitudes from a very early age, and probably from parental influence. There is considerable evidence that his own family held views of this kind, and they simply indoctrinated Lovecraft into these conceptions. But what disappoints me in this whole matter is that in this one aspect of his thought, Lovecraft did not exhibit the open-mindedness that he displayed elsewhere. He remained a racist right to the end. Although gradually he shifted from the notion of biological racism to some sort of cultural racism, he felt that different culture groups were radically incompatible with each other and therefore should be held separate to pursue their own course in human culture. There's a grain of truth to that, but I think he far exaggerated it, and Lovecraft clearly felt simply uncomfortable with people of different ethnic or racial backgrounds.
Did his admiration for fascistic socialism and his racialism ever lead him to... He died in 1937, so he would have seen the rise of Hitler.
Well, it is an embarrassment to say that Lovecraft vigorously supported Hitler early on. When Hitler arose in 1932-33, we find a number of letters in which Lovecraft says, "Well, yes, there are all sorts of bad things about Hitler, but by God, I like the boy." He actually says that in a letter. Very embarrassing. But later on, there is evidence that Lovecraft did hear around 1936 of some of the horrors that Germany was already going through at the time, and all of a sudden you find him sort of shutting up about Hitler in the last year or two of his life. In fact, it has to be admitted that this whole racialist strain does enter his fiction as well. in several stories, such as The Shadow over Innsmouth, the alien entities, even though they are postulated as coming from outer space or from the depths of the sea or wherever, are clearly symbols for the foreigners that bothered Lovecraft so much. In fact, The Shadow over Innsmouth is clearly a sort of warning about the dangers of what would have been called miscegenation, the mixing of different races. And that theme runs through much of Lovecraft's work.
Did other political themes enter any of the stories?
Well, I think later on, especially in two of his longer stories, At the Mountains of Madness and The Shadow Out of Time, one can see that these the extraterrestrials that he puts on stage are clearly symbols for the way Lovecraft hoped human civilization would develop. In fact, it is in The Shadow Out of Time that the term fascistic socialism is coined, and you can see that these alien civilizations are meant to be symbols for the sort of political and economic reorganization that Lovecraft hoped would happen in human civilization as well.
I really want to thank you for joining us today, Mr. Joshi. That's been fascinating. There's such a growing fascination with Lovecraft's work, and I see that you have, in your own writing, begun to spin off many subsidiary projects of people who were his contemporaries and influencers, and you have a volume out now of collected works of famous atheist writings throughout history.
Mm-hmm, yes.
And what are some of the other things that you have on the table coming out?
Let me just say one thing. One of Lovecraft's friends, Robert Bloch, who later became famous as the author of the novel Psycho, once said, "Lovecraft was my university, and in many ways I feel the same way. That is to say, Lovecraft has opened me up to so many different aspects of thought that I would never have approached otherwise, and that, I think, has led me to pursue some of these other topics." Yes, my anthology of atheism was in many ways a spin-off of my interest in Lovecraft's atheistic thought. I've done work on such writers as Ambrose Bierce, again inspired in part by Lovecraft. Specifically in terms of my projects dealing with Lovecraft, I have just published a complete collection of his poetry, the first time his poetry has been collected in one volume. Penguin is about to issue a second volume of annotated Lovecraft stories. It'll be called The Thing on the Doorstep and Other Weird Stories. And I have just published an annotated version of The Shadow Out of Time. This is the first time that story has been published in a textually corrected form. The manuscript of that story surfaced a few years ago, and it has never appeared as Lovecraft wrote it until now.
Now, as I discovered, people who go to the web and punch in Lovecraft will find an enormous number of websites and pages devoted to him out there. But there is a collection being started at a site called Lovecraft Archive, I understand, that you are collaborating on.
Yeah, the H.P. Lovecraft Archive, run by Donovan Laux, really is, I think, the best and most accurate source for information on Lovecraft. There is a tremendous amount of information about Lovecraft and about everything else on the Internet, as everybody knows. But I have been working with Donovan Laux on this site, and I think we have made it a very good site for both biographical and critical information.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.